My name is Jackie Brolsma. I'm on staff here, and I have worked in the field of chemical dependency and alcoholism treatment for about the last 12 years. I'm a master's level nurse and have been counseling families and individuals with alcoholism and chemical dependency problems in a variety of settings, both hospital-based and outpatient. So I want to just call your attention to the fact that there are some other tapes available in the library on the topic, and we'll just cover a minuscule sort of part of it tonight. So feel free to look in the library, in the tape library, if you're interested further in the topic. I want to give some credit to the person who a lot of the information I'm going to share with you tonight comes from. And he's not Lutheran, but he is a religious man of the cloth. A fellow by the name of Vern Johnson. He's a recovering alcoholic himself. The most well-known book that he's written is called I'll Quit Tomorrow, written originally in 73. Kind of a catchy title. And the second one, besides a lot of pamphlets he's written, is called Intervention. He's the person who is responsible for actually kind of originating the intervention process, which you might have heard about through many famous people. Betty Ford, other well-known celebrities have participated in what's called a family intervention. I won't be talking about that process tonight either, but that might be another topic sometime in the future. I invite your input. If any of you have personal experience or professional work in this area, please feel free to contribute. And if I'm not talking loud enough, also please let me know, because that can be real frustrating if you can't hear. I want to make some points about the illness of alcoholism and chemical dependency, and I'll use those two words interchangeably, alcoholism and chemical dependency. Originally, we started out with the word alcoholism, but when we began to see so many other addictions, such as people getting addicted to Valium, Librium, sleeping pills, heroin, morphine, cocaine. It was too much to call all these Libriumism, Valiumism, cocaineism. So they've all really come under the umbrella of chemical dependency, where the dynamics are really all very much the same. The substance doesn't really matter that much. So if you hear me use those two words interchangeably, I am purposely doing that, and they mean the same, alcoholism and chemical dependency. It was recognized as a treatable illness back in the 40s, and I believe that we're still giving a lot of lip service to it. I think we still approach this condition much as a moral problem or a condition of a lack of willpower, and yet it's one of the most treatable illnesses that we have, and recovery rates are really quite high. But it's an illness that has its own set of symptoms and can be described and can be treated. Some things about this disease is that it's primary, which means that it's not the symptom of another underlying problem. A lot of times people tend to think when they look at somebody who has an alcohol or drug problem is that, oh, it's maybe because of their upbringing, or it's because of who they're married to, or it's because they have these bad kids, or it's because they have this bad job. And we think that it's the symptom of another underlying problem, like maybe not having a good self-concept or having problems with anger. Those are all, or maybe sometimes people say, I drink because my mom didn't put my diapers on right when I was two. And that kind of thinking. And really alcoholism, what we've learned is that those are more the results of the disease rather than the cause of them. It's really an illness in and of itself. And when we talk about it being a disease, we talk about it being a physical, emotional, spiritual, and mental, having all those components to it. And it's primary. It's not the second symptom of another problem. It's sort of like if you were to go to the doctor and you were showing some early signs of diabetes, but you didn't know yet that you had diabetes. Maybe you were just having trouble with your vision. Maybe you were having problems with urination or thirst or whatever. But let's say the doctor misses the diagnosis of diabetes and ends up maybe treating you for visual problems. I don't know. And what's going to happen to the diabetes?
It'll get worse.
It'll get worse. The same, it'll get worse. The same thing will happen with alcoholism or chemical dependency. If people treat just the symptoms, like maybe going to a marriage counselor and thinking, well, if we fix the marriage, maybe the drinking will stop. That's not the case. What happens is the disease still progresses. So it's a primary disease in and of itself. It's not the symptom of another underlying problem. Yeah.
Isn't it true that some people are more susceptible to alcoholism?
Yeah.
Some people can drink a lot and never become alcoholics.
Yes.
And others can't drink very much in there.
We certainly know that it tends to run in families. Speaking French also runs in French-speaking families. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's genetic. But there seems to be a real strong genetic component to it, in the sense that certainly there's been a number of adoption studies done that demonstrate that even when children of alcoholic parents are adopted out into non-alcoholic homes, they become alcoholic at a higher rate than others. And so there is some component there. Whether we inherit alcoholism entirely is very questionable, but certainly the propensity that is certainly there. And also, the environment is a very strong factor. Children of alcoholic become alcoholic. About one-third of all children who have one alcoholic parent will become alcoholic. Two-thirds or higher who have two parents will become alcoholic. So, you know, we're talking about a very much a generational disease.
Does it have to be their parents? Can't it be an aunt or an uncle?
Yes, yes. Yes, it can. Can the aunt and uncle, sibling as well, for sure. That's a whole, I'd like to talk more about that, and we have time, we will. So it's a primary condition. The other thing I've already touched on a little bit is that alcoholism is progressive. It never gets better by itself. Sometimes people think, oh, if I just move away from here, it'll stop. Or maybe if I stop hanging around with these people. Maybe if I just quit for a while, it will get better. And what we know is that the disease progresses over time. It never gets better by itself or goes untreated. People who stop drinking for a period of time and later in their life resume drinking again actually really don't pick up as if they start over again. It's as if the disease had been progressing all during that time, which is why sometimes you see people who maybe have been sober 20, 30 years, start drinking again, and in a very short period of time, they either die or become as chronic or worse than what they were earlier in their drinking years. So it's a progressive illness. It doesn't get better by itself, and I really want to emphasize that. The other thing I want to say is that it's chronic. Sometimes you hear people talk about people going in for the cure. There is no cure for alcoholism. We talk about it being a chronic condition in the sense that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. It's kind of like you can't be a little bit pregnant. You either are or you aren't. And it's an illness that does remain with you. It's very, I mean, the recovery, it's one of the wonderful illnesses in the sense that as long as the person abstains and works a program of a spiritual program, actually, in their recovery, they need not really ever worry about relapsing, you know, into drinking again. But it is chronic. But the recovery rate is far higher in this chronic illness than it is from, say, arthritis or cancer. Recovery rates with treatment are somewhere up in the 60 to 80%, which is a real, which says a lot for treatment. But it is chronic. Nobody ever gets cured from alcoholism. We talk about it being a recovery, an ongoing recovery, not just a cure. That recovery, I want to say, is based on total abstinence from all mood-altering chemicals. Recovery is not based on being able to control the intake. Usually alcoholics have tried for years to do the controlling of it. And recovery is based on total abstinence. And sometimes it's very difficult for family and friends to understand that. They may have somebody who goes in for treatment or a friend that they know, and they don't understand why they can't maybe just have a little bit. For them, it's somewhat like being a diabetic. They have to abstain from sugar. Alcoholics have to abstain from alcohol and all mood-altering chemicals. Because the other chemicals can also produce a mood change that could potentially relapse them in to the same condition and the same pattern. So recovery is based on total abstinence from all mood-altering chemicals. Finally, this disease is potentially fatal. We know that people who are alcoholic who continue drinking and do not enter recovery have a shorter lifespan of about 20 years. It is a fatal illness. We know that people will die from it. And actually, it's the third leading cause of death. Many people think it would be higher than that if statistics from accidents and things that are definitely related to alcohol intake would be put in there, such as homicides and other things that are related to the intake of alcohol. Okay, those are just some introductory comments. And from there, what I'm going to be talking about is really why we call alcoholism and chemical dependency an emotional or a feeling disease. That's a component of the illness I'm going to focus on a lot in this particular talk. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about the progression, but I'm also going to be talking about anybody who uses a mood-altering substances or takes in alcohol. When I get to the point where I'm talking about the illness or addiction or dependency, I'll let you know that. But I am going to be talking about it beginning with people who drink at all, anything. And I'm going to be relating that to our feelings and what happens. This is kind of like a feeling continuum, where on this end we will put the height of emotion or euphoria, where, you know, I'm on top of the world, I can handle everything, I feel really good about myself. Euphoria, the peak of feeling good. And down here, we'll put pain, be that emotional or physical, where we say, I'm no darn good, nobody likes me, you know, I'm nothing. Any kind of emotional pain or discomfort is down on the other on the other end. And actually, I'm going to probably be talking about more emotional pain than I will physical. Okay? And this is somewhere here where normal is. If you all find out where that is, let me know. I'm still trying to find it. But we'll pretend that somewhere on this continuum, we fluctuate in the period of a day, in a lifetime. But those are the range of emotions. I'm going to be using that to relate the intake of alcohol and the use of mood-altering chemicals. And I want to say that the progression for people varies. Some people, younger people who start drinking at an early age, can progress into alcoholism very quickly, simply because their growth and development is still continuing. Some people can drink for 20 years before they show an alcoholic pattern or a chemical addiction pattern. So the progression can be different for different people. We know that women, female alcoholics, progress much faster than men do. We also know that youth do. So the progression can be different for everyone. All right. How many of you remember the first time you ever had a drink of alcohol? Some of you, what do you remember about it? You're smiling.
Well, I was 33 with a bunch of JCs, and they took me into my first cocktail lounge, and most of them were about 25, 27, and I got carded and thrown out.
At 33.
Yeah. I was so nervous. You know, I'd never been around alcohol. We didn't have it in the family. Mother was very much against it, and I'd never been in a place like that, and I was looked young, and I was feeling real nervous about it. It was real kind of fun.
But you did drink.
Yeah, after I went back, I got my driver's license and so forth, so I could prove my age, they let me in.
What do you remember about the drinking experience, the intake of alcohol?
It was kind of, well, I've been with this JC's group for a while, you know, but it was kind of like feeling like one of the group and, and kind of an acceptance ritual.
And so it was a good feeling?
Yes.
A good feeling. What about you?
Oh, I don't remember any what happened. I was pretty old anyway.
You got stoned, in other words.
No, nobody's stoned.
For most of you.
Never. I don't remember. I just, you know.
For most of you, what do you remember about how you felt?
Well,
to begin with, for me, it was the sweeter drinks. It didn't taste like alcohol.
Yeah.
It had orange juice in it or Coke or whatever.
How did you feel?
Lose all inhibition.
Didn't drink enough to get that stage.
My first drink was wine in church, and I felt kind of guilty because our family never approved of it.
Well, I don't know about you, but for me, the very first time that I felt or tasted alcohol was, I grew up in the Midwest, and good German, Dutch family. And where to reach a certain age, you're able to imbibe, you know, at family events. And mine was a wedding dance, and I think I was probably about 18 or 19, maybe a little older. And what I remember is that I liked how it made me feel. I had never quite felt that way before. It was a positive feeling. And for most people, their intake of alcohol, the first phase is learning the mood swing. We experience a change in the way that we feel. Now, nobody stays here very long, okay? This is usually your first time event with alcohol or a couple or whatever. But what you find is that you move in that direction, right? You feel good. I felt good. You know, and I felt like I could dance, you know, with everybody. And it was at a dance, and I did. I danced with, you know, people I probably wouldn't have danced with before, but it was fun. And I felt free. Inhibitions were, you know, lifted. And it was a positive experience. In other words, I felt good, all right? And I woke up the next day, and I felt fine. I hadn't done anything that embarrassed me. I hadn't gone home with somebody I didn't want to go home with. I hadn't, you know, danced on top of the table or, you know, maybe stripped off my clothes or anything crazy like that. It was a positive experience. I liked how it made me feel. It gave me a sense of kind of relaxation. And I hadn't gotten drunk. And it was a predictable thing. It was controllable. If I wanted to feel a little bit better, what did I do? Drink just a little bit more, right? It was a predictable experience. It could be controlled. And it was determined by how much that I drank. And it was temporary, right? It wasn't permanent. The length of my mood swing was determined by the amount, right? It was a safe experience. I came back to normal. And the other thing I remember about alcohol is that it was fast. I'd never learned to feel that good that quickly before. And it was a fast kind of experience. Basically, what we all learned is that there's somewhat of a friend in the chemical alcohol. It's lubricating. That's why we serve it at parties, right? It loosens people up. And I'm not talking about alcoholism now. I'm not talking about addiction. I'm just talking about purely social use. And the very first thing that all of us learn as social drinkers is that we can change the way that we feel. We learn the mood swing. And we can trust it and the effects that it's going to have on us. It's dependable. And we can control it. And it'll provide a positive mood swing every time. We know that. So it's not long before we take what we have learned and we develop a relationship to this chemical where we now learn to seek the mood swing. And again, I'm not talking about harmful dependency yet, addiction or alcoholism or anything. I'm talking purely about social use, where we learn to have a relationship with the chemical alcohol. And it's in this period that it still remains positive, and it's basically applying what we learned to our lifestyle. In other words, when I want to feel a little bit of this euphoria, that's when I use alcohol. Parties, friends coming over, celebration, with a meal, maybe some relaxation perhaps, maybe a festive event. But we use it at appropriate times and places. All right? Now, once the person moves into the disease or harmful dependency, we're talking about inappropriate use. At this stage, We don't drink before we go to church. We aren't drinking before we go to our job. We're not drinking, you know, before we go out on a date or any inappropriate kinds of time. We are still doing it at appropriate time and places. And believe it or not, all of us develop some self-imposed rules in this phase of our alcohol or chemical use, which have to do with sort of our boundaries or our guidelines. And what are some of those? As we move into it, as a person moves into addiction, they end up breaking those guidelines, which is what accounts for the guilt. But what are some of those we say?
Like what? Not drinking before 5 o'clock?
Exactly. I won't drink before 5 o'clock.
Never more than 3 beers.
Yeah. Never more than 3. Amount. Mm-hmm. Okay. What else?
Never drink on an empty stomach.
Never drink on an empty stomach. That's also a common one.
Never drink alone.
Never drink alone.
Only drink wine or beer.
Only drink wine or beer, not hard stuff.
Right.
Only drink out socially with the group. Never buy it and bring it home.
Okay. Only out, perhaps. Maybe only in certain places.
Yeah.
Only with certain people. We develop some rules. Now, none of us usually sit down and say, well, what are my own rules about drinking? You know, we don't do that. But as a person moves into harmful dependency, I'm going to show you that a person ends up violating those rules, which is what accounts for the tremendous amount of guilt that somebody who is alcoholic or chemically dependent begins to experience. And those rules end up being violated, such as, you know, saying, I'm never going to drink before noon. And then at 10 o'clock we say, well, it's noon in Chicago. You know, that's a little lighter way of looking at it, but nonetheless, we all do have kind of those guidelines around our alcohol use. When people move into harmful dependency, they end up violating these. It's in this phase now, again, that a person still continues to experience euphoria and to come back to normal. Occasionally, intoxication may be experienced by all drinkers. Just because somebody gets intoxicated does not mean necessarily that they're alcoholic. But when the person does that, they might experience what? Some physical pain, a hangover, a headache. And they maybe move over into this other side briefly and experience a little bit of discomfort. And they wake up and most people say, Kyle, I'm not going to do that again. And so the next time they drink, it's no big deal. They don't drink as much. And they're able to change that, right? Now, they swing safely back to normal. Now, people who experience that physical pain or the hangover might also experience some minimal emotional pain. If some of you might have maybe gotten intoxicated at some time and maybe you did something embarrassing. Maybe you did something that was out of line in some particular situation. But nonetheless, the activity for the person who is still just a social drinker is primarily in this realm, right? And this becomes a well-worn path. And that's, go ahead.
In other words, alcohol makes you lose control.
Not always. No.
I think that's not what I said. People are different when they've had a drink.
Well,
they're not the same people.
Not everybody. It is a mood-altering chemical. It does change the way that you feel. But your body can also tolerate about an ounce of alcohol an hour. And that's about the rate that a person should drink if they're not going to overdose their body, so to speak. But not everybody experiences a personality change with the use of alcohol. But it's at this place where there might be the headache and there might be a little bit of embarrassment, but in terms of this, that little bit was worth it, right? We say, you know, that for the good feelings that I got and the fun that it was, that little bit of discomfort was worth it. And I'm not talking about harmful dependency yet. I'm talking yet about social use, all right? I want to really make that clear. Yes. And that pattern becomes well known, and there are many, many drinkers and users who are in this phase. All right? That's where most of the people are. One, And in this phase, a person is still controlling the amounts, the times, and the outcome. It's all predictable yet in this phase. For some unknown reason, 1 in 10 people will move beyond this. 1 in 10 people who drink. Some people say it's more than that. But about 10% of people who use alcohol will move into alcoholism. So say in this room there's maybe 20 or 25 people, there would be about 2.5 people with the disease of alcoholism. And another 6 people would be, for each of those, would be severely affected. So we're talking about quite an epidemic in one sense. All right. So
another 6 people would be affected by the 2 point something alcoholism, like friends,
no,
family, or another
6 for each one.
So another 6 might be problem drinkers?
No, they would be affected as family or friends.
Right, that's what I mean.
Emotionally affected.
Right.
Definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
Are we talking then 10% might become alcoholics, and 6% then of the 6 out of 100 might become these problem persons?
No, no.
I'm getting them figured out.
Okay, I'm sorry. 1 in 10 people who drink alcohol will become alcoholic.
Okay.
For every 1 alcoholic, there are at least 6 people around that person who are significantly affected. Okay? To the point that we also feel that they need treatment for their involvement with that person. All right? Social users remain in this phase that I've talked about. Victims of chemical dependency now will progress into phase 3 and 4, which I will call harmful. And this is a phase where the person begins to experience more and more periodic loss of control over their chemical use, and they're no longer able to predict the outcome once they start using. In other words, I only intended to have 3, and all of a sudden they're having 6, 8, 10, whatever. And the loss of control begins to happen. And that results in behavior then that violate those rules or values that I talked about earlier. The best way for me to explain that is to begin to talk about a scenario. Let's say John Doe is this upstanding person in the community, and he goes to a party at his boss's house. His wife goes with him, and he starts drinking with everybody else. And he ends up getting intoxicated. And he ends up feeling euphoria, okay? But then he also ends up, let's say, he puts a lampshade on his head, and he ends up pouring booze down his boss's wife's dress, okay? Not exactly socially acceptable behavior, right? Things that he would not do if he were not under the influence, isn't that right? And those are things that John Doe normally wouldn't do as a person. But what's happened is that he has now experienced not only euphoria, but let's say he goes home, his wife, she's moved into codependency, a whole other thing, which is the family disease. She's willing to drive him home, make excuses for him, tuck him into bed, clean him up, and he wakes up the next morning, she's got one of those nice shrill sounding voices, and starts to tell him what he did last night at the party. Now, does he want to hear it? No. No way. No way. Because what? To hear it means emotional pain. I did what? I poured booze down my boss's wife's dress. Are you kidding me? I wouldn't do anything like that. And to have to admit to any of that would be very painful, right? I mean, who would want to? Right? And so this is where we begin to see something that we call the person's denial system or their distorted memory. And we often wonder sometimes why people who are alcoholic are so out of touch with what's happening to them and their denial. Now the first thing is, as his wife starts to tell him what he did last night at the party where he got drunk and out of hand, is he might say, "That never happened. You're crazy, woman. I didn't do any of those things. And what is one thing that could have happened to him? What could have physiologically had happened?
He could have had a blackout.
He could have had a blackout, exactly. Do you all know what a blackout is? A lot of people think it's passing out. A blackout is really strictly a period of time when you don't remember what you did while or after drinking. It's not being passed out. Blackouts are a memory lapse, or like amnesia. A person doesn't remember what they did while they're after drinking. If you ever hear the story of Wilbur Mills, a well-known recovering alcoholic who was in Congress, he'll tell you that he got up and gave speeches in front of Congress in blackouts, never knew that he was doing it. Blackouts are a period of time when the person is functioning, perhaps normally, appears like it, but he doesn't remember what he did while or after drinking. So physiologically, to distort his memory, that could have happened. Also a good way to avoid feeling this, right? Now the second thing is a person develops quite an extensive rationalization system. And this is where it becomes very difficult for people who are around people who are alcoholic to understand. But what happens is the person experiences that first episode of emotional pain. And this is the place where I kind of go inside. What happens to people is there's an ouch. They go ouch on the inside. They end up doing something they normally would not do sober. And it's violating their value system as to who they are as a person. And so, you know, his wife say, let's say he didn't black out. He does remember what happened. And she tells him what he did last night at the party. Now, does he want to admit to that? No. None of us want to feel pain like that, right? And so, one of the things that might begin to happen is he might say something like, others behaved at the party worse than me. I mean, did you see Jim over here? He was really loaded. Right? What do we call that?
Projection.
We call it minimizing, actually. That's minimizing. Or projection. It's not that bad. Don't worry about it. I can handle it. It only happened that one time. No big deal. Usually people around the person then end up believing that. And so does the person who's saying it. Because there's no way the person will go to great lengths to avoid experiencing the emotional pain. None of us want to feel that. We'll do anything. And so if he can convince himself and you of that, he has protected himself and also deluded himself. So he might minimize it. Another thing he might say is, well, if dinner would have been served on time, I wouldn't have drank so much. Mm-hmm. It's the host and hostess problem. If they would have served the meal on time, it wouldn't have been so bad. Right? It's not my problem. What do we call that?
Excuses.
Or in psychology, we call it rationalizations. Rationalizing it away. Honey, if you would have stuck with me at the party, if you would have gone off and talked to all these other people, I wouldn't have gotten so intoxicated. It's not my fault. It's yours. We'll do anything to avoid this emotional pain that we're beginning to experience from the use of alcohol. Because what do I not want to give up? But this. And I have found a friend in alcohol, so I'll go to great lengths to protect it. Right? Or, another good one is, I drank on an empty stomach. It's the empty stomach's problem, not my drinking. Or people who get a DWI, or whatever you call it in Minnesota, or whatever state you're from, getting drunk driving charge, comes before the court and tells the judge, I know the solution, I just won't drive anymore. I won't change my drinking, I'll quit my driving. You can often, the easiest way, you don't need lots of credentials to diagnose an alcoholic. In many ways, it's very easy. They're the people who will do anything, change everything in their life, except the use of alcohol. They're willing to give up family, friends, jobs, their health to protect their use of alcohol. And those are all part of distorted memory, because what happens to the person is they develop a thick wall of delusion and denial. where they can't see what's happening to them. And people don't walk into treatment because they're just walking down the street and they happen to see a treatment center and say, gee, I think I'll go into treatment here. I'd like to check it out. They are there because of some pain in some part of their life. And that pain is exactly what gets people well in recovery. And being willing to feel that is what recovery and treatment is all about. Because for years they've been medicating it, avoiding it. We all do little things to avoid our pain. But to have to admit that, yeah, I did that stuff at the party last night, or yeah, I felt guilty, is saying that I violated my own value system. People who do not have the illness, people who are up here, are able to change their drinking pattern and it's no big deal. Because they already realize they violated who they were as a person. For people who are alcoholic or chemically dependent, they don't realize that they cannot change their alcoholic use because they've already moved into harmful dependency and addiction. And so they're unable to change that. So part of that distorted memory are those things. The other thing is something that we call euphoric recall. One of the best things for recovery from alcoholism is making use of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was founded back in the 30s by a doctor and a stockbroker. And it's a model for many other kinds of self-help groups today called 12-step programs. It's a spiritual program which basically says six things. Trust God, clean house, and serve others is basically a synopsis of it. But there are so many programs who have been modeled after that now. We have Emotions Anonymous, we have Overeaters Anonymous, we have Narcotics Anonymous, we have Gamblers Anonymous. The most recent one that I've heard of is one called Paranoids Anonymous. And I called it to find out where they were meeting and they wouldn't tell me. No. One of the reasons that Alcoholics Anonymous works so well is that it guards against something called euphoric recall. Euphoric recall is being able to only remember this side of the disease. In other words, in recovery, when a person has stopped drinking, what they begin to do, if you talk to people who have relapsed, is what they remember is this end. They suddenly remember how good it tasted, how they felt, and they don't remember the divorces, the job loss, the pain. It's like this is totally blocked out. It's recalling only the euphoria, euphoric recall. One of the best protections against that is continued involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous, a self-help program where people go to meetings. And when you go to a meeting and a newcomer comes in, what do you think they're talking about as a newcomer? They're talking about this side. Yeah. Right. They're talking about all the pain as a newcomer. They're right there. And suddenly what clicks in for the recovering person is, oh yeah, I remember now the whole thing. And they don't have to go back and relive all that pain. By being in touch with people who have experienced that, that helps them to stay sober and in their recovery. So that's all part of the distorted memory. And when you wonder sometimes why an alcoholic can't see what they're doing, it's because usually people feed into that denial system and believe the excuses and the lies, and they avoid talking about what's happening. Now, the social drinker will change their drinking and their pattern. The person who is chemically dependent will not, because they don't think that there's any other way to get this high. But it's in this phase that a person maybe experiences still some euphoria, but more and more they're beginning to experience more of this end. More pain associated with their alcohol use than euphoria. And then there might be, in this place, a person might have the preoccupation with it. They might begin to experience their lifestyle changing and revolving around alcohol. Things, activities they used to do that didn't involve alcohol suddenly don't matter to them anymore. They're involved only in maybe shooting pool or golf or things where alcohol is a real big part. They might be real specific about their times that they want to use alcohol. Nobody interferes with my Friday night, right? Or this is my day to drink, everybody get out of the way. Getting real rigid. They now begin to regularly break those rules that we talked about earlier. Their tolerance physiologically might go up. In other words, it takes more alcohol to get the effect that they used to get from a smaller amount. They might develop ingenious ways to keep and use the alcohol, like hiding, sneaking drinks. They begin to have so much self-hate that they project that onto people around them. And more the person's life is beginning to deteriorate spiritually, emotionally, and in their relationships, maybe professionally, in all kinds of ways. And I think the thing to remember, I believe, is that people who are suffering from alcoholism often sometimes will go and seek out help spiritually from people. We know that about 1/3 of people who have a problem with alcohol will go and talk to a clergy person. More and more people are clergy are understanding this disease, but often what they used to get told was, well, just cut down, or pray a little more, or go to church a little more. And they would try to do those things, and it wouldn't help, and they ended up feeling more alienated from God and their church and the whole spiritual part of their life. And so that's changed now. I think more and more, you know, clergy are recognizing that it's more sophisticated than that. The final phase, though, is where a person begins to live more and more in that left-hand side of the feeling chart. No longer do they start drinking here and go here. They live down here, and they just want to feel normal. I don't care if I get a rush anymore. I just want to be able to function. I don't care if I get a high. I don't care if I get some euphoria. I just want to be able to get through the day. And we call this using to just feel normal. More and more their life is painful. There's more losses. There's more physical damage. The blackouts occur more frequently. There might be physical addiction. And this is also where there's a lot of paranoid thinking that happens. People thinking, everybody's watching my drinking. I know that they are. And we say sometimes people who are chemically dependent are extra sensitive people. That's also the case in recovery. That's why it's so fun to work with them. Chemically dependent people are people who want to experience life more deeply and more richly. And oftentimes they have antennas that are way out here, whereas normal people are a little bit like about here. Chemically dependent people are out here. And oftentimes, physiologically this is the case, if somebody is a heavy user of alcohol or alcoholic, they're much like you know, a little baby. If you've ever seen a little baby that's newly a newborn, and you make a loud noise like that, what does the baby do? Mm. You know, goes like this, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't go, you know, just make a turn. It goes, jumps. People who are alcoholic are the same way. They overreact, not only to physical kinds of stimulation, but also things that happen to them. Everything is a big deal. Now, it's a wonderful quality to be extra sensitive, but the disadvantage to that is that everything in life does become a big deal. And that's why the ongoing program of Alcoholics Anonymous is so wonderful, to help keep life in perspective for them. So the paranoid thinking might happen in this phase. Also, they might try geographic escapes. Maybe if I moved away from here, I wouldn't drink so much. Maybe it's where I live that's the problem. And they find out that they go along with themselves. They might have the loss of desire to live, and maybe a complete spiritual bankruptcy. And this is where maybe suicide takes place, or just, you know, Skid Row. As many alcoholics will tell you, Skid Row is not a geographic place, it's a state of mind. Many people who are alcoholic feel like they're on Skid Row, even though they're not there geographically. Contrary to popular opinion, there's no invisible line that people pass over from being alcoholic or chemically dependent from the social drinker. We all look, but we don't listen, I think, in relation to chemical dependency. Oftentimes, we avoid them. We're embarrassed to talk about it. We might rescue them, protect them, make excuses for them, or even try to control it. But chemically dependent will focus on anything but changing their alcohol or changing their behavior. are changing the drinking. Social drinkers have no need to rationalize or to make excuses. And yet, what I tell people who are chemically dependent is that that tells you that they have a value system. The disease of alcoholism takes people away from who they really are as God created them to be. And feeling guilt in recovery is a positive sign because it tells them that they have a value system that they violated. People who don't have a value system are the people who are in prisons and continue to commit crimes. But feeling guilt is a positive sign. It tells us that we have a value system. Chemical dependent people will do anything to protect this euphoria. It's a tremendous sense of loss because they have a sense of no other way to get that. And so they'll go to great lengths, you know, to protect it. If there were no emotional pain involved, there'd be no recovery. The chemically dependent now becomes a victim of their own defense system, all of that. They are victims of what they've created. And more, they're dependent on the alcohol and unable to see their real behavior. They can't see what's really happening to them. A prison of denial and delusion is around them. Chemically dependent people kind of build up one brick at a time. Sort of like, I can quit anytime I want. Next time it'll be different. Wait and see. And growth stops. They stop growing emotionally, they stop growing spiritually, and even their health. And that prison of denial and delusion is complete because most of their life is down here now. And a lot of people think we have to wait till it gets down there before we can help them. And that's not actually the case. Chemically dependents are suffering people. Few people see the suffering, most see the misleading behavior. Why can't they see what's happening to them, we say. If you loved me, you'd quit, you might scream and yell. The chemically dependent can't see. Intervention is required by skilled people. There are sensitive people with high value systems. If they didn't have that value system, there'd be no emotional pain. Bright, talented, and beautiful people well worth saving. This same progression and deterioration in emotions happens for family and people who are emotionally involved with somebody who's chemically dependent as well. And that's a whole other topic of codependency and family survival that I'll probably cover in another session. I'd like to leave some time for questions, so.
The tragedy of your 1 in 10 is that it's not predictable who that one's going to be. Could you address something like that? How would you...
Well, we know that there are some risk factors.
Does that mean that people should not drink at all?
No.
Of course, you don't know whether you or I will be that one person?
Yeah, nobody's immune. We call it an equal opportunity disease. In the sense that no profession is immune.
Right.
We know that high rates occur in psychiatry, dentists, professional athletes, politicians, and clergy are all high rates places. Children of alcoholics, if there's any family history of alcoholism, I encourage people to get an evaluation of their own alcohol use. The risk is, and I encourage people who have two parents who are alcoholic not to drink at all. I think the risk factors are far too great. Coming from families where chronic depression or depression was a problem, are also at higher risk. Let's see, what are some other problems? Liver problems definitely can put people, even that precede alcoholism, certainly the liver gets damaged, it's one organ that's very involved in detoxifying of alcohol. But people who have liver complications often don't tolerate alcohol very well, and consequently their risk is higher. Being able to predict who will become alcoholic is a real important subject of research right now. And they're finding out a lot of things. for one very early study, which I hesitate to quote, but is showing that people who have are born with what we call augmenters, or people who augment incoming stimuli. In other words, augment means enhance, or have difficulty taking in a lot of stimuli. That physiological makeup, coupled with a poor relationship with a same-sex parent, is showing some predictability of becoming alcoholic. Mainly because they find that those people who are augmenters don't react to the chemical alcohol the same way that you and I might as normal people. They have an exaggerated response. And oftentimes when we learn to drink with other people, and what we learn about it is kind of how everybody else reacts. And people who are what we call augmenters react very differently, you know, to alcohol, and they almost need to be taught that their reaction to alcohol is very different. But that situation, coupled with a poor relationship with a same-sex parent, in some very early studies right now, is showing that that may have some predictability. But I would, I mean, that's nothing to quote me on. So, but it is a good point. We don't know the 1 in 10.
That's right. This idea about the primary illness, I believe that's the term used.
Mm-hmm.
I've had the thought that in some situations where, for example, a husband is very, very successful, very active, college graduate, and a wife I've known that is not a college graduate and felt, you know, unequal, unable to keep up with, and so on. There were so many implications there that when the alcoholism occurred for that wife, we kind of felt, I guess we felt it wasn't necessarily primary, but kind of secondary in her relationships, or feeling inadequate in her life situation. Is that far off?
That might well be the case. The problem with that viewpoint is, though, people spend time then trying to fix those other things while the alcoholism progresses. And very often people who don't understand the disease will then look at all those factors and say, well, gee, maybe we just give her more education, we make her feel better about herself, her drinking will stop. And that doesn't happen. The disease worsens. Now, it's sort of like if you fall down, say, and break your leg, what do? You go get your leg fixed, right? You don't sort of sit there and try to figure out, now, what did I fall over? How did this happen? I've got to figure this out. You go and get your leg fixed. You might come back later and take a look at what I did for that to happen, but not while the person is laying there with a broken leg. You go and fix that first.
There was no attempt. There was a denial of what was going on,
right,
her part and the husband's part and all,
yeah,
that. So really no attempt was made.
Right.
It's anything.
Right. But that's not uncommon for people to do what you're saying, is to try to figure out, well, what made them drink? And maybe if we fix that, you know, that will make everything all better. And it doesn't work that way.
Well, I think that's why people don't seek help. It's the stigma attached to it. That was true of Betty Ford. She denied it all along.
Uh-huh.
And it's true in our own families. We cover up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like you mentioned about this wife taking care of him and smoothing everything over. And that's the worst thing that we can possibly do.
Mm-hmm. Because what does that all feed then? What I was talking about was the denial and the delusion for the person. Because if people are rescuing and covering and making excuses, the person never has to experience the harmful consequences.
Right, he's protected.
Yeah.
But they would have to come to that decision themselves. Nobody else could make it for them to go get treatment, would they? They'd have to.
Well, a lot of people, you know, we put off doing a lot of things because we think the person has to hit bottom before they can, you know, get any help.
Isn't it true that most of the people are in that
3A
category deny that they are?
Denial is a real primary symptom.
So,
but that doesn't necessarily mean that it should stop us from intervening in somebody's, you know, illness, you know, in order to get them treatment. Because a part of treatment is helping them to see, you know, break down their own denial and to, you know, accept responsibility for recovery.
Yeah, it's like with the Betty Ford thing. It wasn't that she decided to seek help.
It was
that there was an intervention done by her family.
Yeah.
And isn't that happening more?
More and more.
Where isn't the person that hits bottom or whatever? Mm-hmm. Or,
you know. If you read her story, it's kind of interesting in the sense that the first intervention is a way of lovingly confronting a person with their illness. It involves a trained counselor who works with the family or friends or employer or clergy or someone, working with them and collecting data about the person's alcohol use or their chemical use in a way that they lovingly present it non-judgmentally with the facts. You know, observable kinds of information. And then sharing how they feel about that experience. And that is really one way that you can attack the denial system, and the person cannot, you know, then kind of escape from hiding and trying to, you know, avoid it. In Betty Ford's case, the family did that initially. But actually the family had not been this. One of the other key factors in intervention is having it be significant people. Significant people have to be involved in it, otherwise it doesn't matter to them. And actually the people who saw more of Betty Ford's alcohol and chemical and Valium use were maids and chauffeurs and people like that. The family were really kind of hidden from it in the sense that she was very much a closet user. And so the first intervention was not effective essentially in getting her into treatment. I never like to call an intervention a failure because sometimes it's a chain of events that it gets people there. But the second intervention they did, they called in the chauffeurs and the housekeepers and the maids and all the people who actually saw her. And they were more instrumental, actually, in having more data to confront her with, to break down her denial system. But yeah, that's exactly right.
Isn't it also very, with in an alcoholism in a family, it's very hard for those individuals that are affected to actually get together and discuss the situation, mm-hmm. and take some action, because they're all pretty isolated within going on.
There's a real strong rule in a family that's called a no-talk rule. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like pretending there's an elephant in the front living room and we all know it's there, but we walk around it and maybe even clean up after it, but we pretend it's not there. Yet we all know it's there. Mm-hmm. We might talk about it, but what is it? Mom or dad's drinking, maybe, but we avoid, you know, the actually facing up to it. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because sometimes people in the family, that force and that rule is very strong, and when somebody breaks open with it, often the reaction that they get is, oh, you know, you're overreacting, or I don't want to deal with it, oh yeah, they've been a lush for years, I don't care anymore, and that kind of thing happens. So it is very difficult. But really, intervention only takes one person. One person can be effective. So.
But the intervention has to take place well before the candidate accepts the problem that he's got a problem. In other words, you have to get your intervention team together then with an outsider helping before he can do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's preparation involved in it.
Yeah,
is that what you mean?
Preparation.
Yeah.
Getting data and that sort of thing. Long before the person who has a problem admits it and realizes he has a problem.
Yeah, well, some people, I never like to say that anyone voluntarily enters treatment. I mean, there are people who come there, certainly it's all voluntary. But there's usually pressure and pain in somebody's life. Let's face it, none of us make changes in our life until there's pain somewhere, right? And part of that intervention process is helping them to experience the pain a little sooner or not comforting them from it. You know, or sheltering them from it. And so there is preparation involved, and that's why it's actually better to work with somebody who's trained in doing interventions versus people who try to do it on their own often end up getting so emotionally involved and ends up getting into a fight with the person or trying to argue with them. And, you know, this person is very good at this already. I mean, you'll never win if you try to battle about, you know, the whole situation. Okay, well, thank you for your attention. Thank you.